Welcome to Upvote, a politics podcast from Wired and Ars Technica UK. Each week until the general election, we'll be discussing the increasingly important relationship between politics and technology, which more and more is coming to shape political life, and really, life everywhere. I'm Roland Manthorpe, Associate Editor of Wired.
And I'm Kelly Fiveash, News Editor of Ars Technica.
Today we're going to be discussing the WannaCry ransomware attack, which, at the time we're recording this, on the afternoon of Wednesday 15th of May, has hit more than 200,000 computers in 150 countries, encrypting their files and demanding payment to decrypt them. It's attacked businesses, governments, and, most notably, NHS hospitals. In fact, in this country, it's widely and rather parochially known as the NHS cyber attack.
And that name is indicative of the way this outbreak has been politicised. Almost as soon as it happened, the political blame game started. Labour accused the Tories of not spending enough money on the NHS to safeguard critical IT systems. The Tories responded by saying that the NHS used tech built under a Labour government and that hospitals should have kept their systems updated.
Lots of people have also been blaming Microsoft, which withheld critical security updates from users unless they agreed to pay for them, behaviour which looks suspiciously like its own form of ransomware.
Yes, and Microsoft in turn have issued very strong statements blaming the NSA for stockpiling vulnerabilities in systems, then allowing them to leak. Microsoft itself said an equivalent scenario with conventional weapons would be the US military having some of its Tomahawk missiles stolen.
I'm not sure about that analogy, if I'm honest.
Same. WannaCry is bad, but it's not a cruise missile.
Yeah. And the accusations didn't stop there, though. As two security firms revealed on Monday, they'd found possible evidence linking the attack to North Korea. So, how did it happen? Who's at fault? And what will the political consequences be? Not only in the narrow frame of British party politics, but also geopolitically. Plus, more broadly, what does it mean for the future if our incredibly complex computerised systems can be disrupted by a relatively simple attack, spread by a worm of the kind that hasn't really been seen since the days of I Love You and My Doom? Early 2000s reference for you there. To discuss all this, we met up with two of the world's leading cybersecurity experts, Hatem Naguib, Senior Vice President and General Manager of Security at Barracuda, and Raj Somani, Chief Scientist at McAfee and Intel, who's also a member of the Advisory Group on Internet Security at Europol Cybercrime Centre. And we started by asking Raj what he thought when he first heard of the attack.
Raj, I was doing a briefing for law enforcement, and I started to get emails in my inbox and my phone started to blow up, and we were hearing stories about a ransomware attack in Spain. And I've got TweetDeck as well, so first thing I did was get up a filter on TweetDeck, and all of a sudden there was more stories coming up, which was the NHS. And to be honest, it took us what, 15-20 minutes to figure out that okay, these are connected, and it was a ransomware variant by the name of WCry or WannaCry. And then as we began to go through it, and in fact, I had to phone my lead analyst, and he was at hospital, and I was like, look, I'm really sorry, dude, but it's all hands to the pump. And to be honest, we just haven't slept since that day. And the sad thing was, on over the weekend, I was on about 400 messages an hour, and my phone was like blowing up. And I was with my daughter, she's about 11 years old, and she put her phone next to mine, and mine was just like a Christmas tree just blowing up. And she looked at me, she goes, Daddy, I can't wait to the day that I get 400 messages an hour. And I just couldn't stop laughing, because I said, I wish I was getting zero like you. So to be honest, this is becoming the norm now, and I think that's the worst thing.
Yeah, because I wanted to ask whether you were surprised, or was it actually something that you've been fearing or waiting for?
Well, I mean, dealing with worms like these, I mean, that's like, what we were dealing with sort of 10 years ago or so. But I guess the way that the digital landscape has changed is kind of like a weekly occurrence. I mean, like you talk about elections, you talk about hacking into cars. I think, I know why I did some stories around that. You talk about, dumps from, government agencies. It is every single day that we kind of veer towards crisis mode to crisis mode, and responses required, and customers asking questions and stuff. So this kind of crisis mode is beginning to become the norm.
And on ransomware in particular, because Hatem, I saw on your website that it says ransomware is the number one cyber threat to businesses today. Is that accurate, or is that just some timely sales?
No, actually, well, timely sales is probably a little bit part of it, but the fact of the matter is, you know, a large portion of customers deal with this on a regular basis. I mean, I'm looking at statistics. Somewhere on the order of 40 to 50% of customers have been hit. You talk to a customer, many times they'll tell you they have been hit, but they don't know where that hit came from. I've talked to partners who are supporting customers who basically say, look, I'm keeping a pool of Bitcoin on the side because when somebody calls, I can just give them the Bitcoin and we can move on. It's a relatively regular occurrence. And I'm with Raj. I think part of what happened on Friday, which was a little different, like we deal with this all the time. It's been coming in for the last several years. There are multiple different variants. The nature of the discussion is usually within us in the tech community. Oh, it's another one. Who's got it? Let's add it to the signature database. Let's move on. When I started to see it come across BBC and started to see the impact on the hospital, it actually got a little different for me. I actually started to say, oh man, this is outside of the purview of what the tech guys are dealing with. You know, people are dealing now with the reality of what the impact of this is, and this is going to get out of control very quickly. And the reaction part of this was, I think, what I think surprised me a little bit more, because it had become much more of the type of attack that stepped outside of commercial interests and became very personal to people.
Because from your point of view, what actually, in terms of process, happens when there's an attack like this? Because like, when you get robbed, you call the police. When there's a fire, you call the fire brigade. Who gets the call, or who takes the call?
That's a good question. And I mean, I can give you a personal story, which was one of my cousins actually had an issue where his Facebook account was hacked. And he went to his local police station and he met the desk sergeant and he said, I need to report a crime. And he says, well, sure, what's the problem? And he said, well, my Facebook account's been hacked. And, you know, he like looked at him like he'd just spoken in Klingon, because it was like, well, what do I do now? And of course, that's the issue, is that, you know, we're dealing with a threat around the digital space whereby it could come from anywhere. You know, it's not like somebody robs a bank. I mean, people don't rob banks with guns. They rob banks with USB sticks now. So the challenge has always become, well, okay, how do we get this reporting structure in place? And in fact, you know, we co-founded an initiative in July, last July, called No More Ransom. And that particular site, part of that site, and I've got to give thanks to Barracuda and Amazon Web Services, and Kaspersky Labs, the Dutch police and Europol, who co-founded this with us, because we've actually got a capability where people can report digital crimes and ransomware back to their local agencies as well. And now we've got hundreds of partners now globally, including law enforcement from all across the world. So part of this issue is that we are, you know, this is kind of like an invisible threat, because we don't actually know the scale of the issue. It's not like how many times are people doing graffiti on trains, which is easy to see, I guess.
I mean, we've touched on it a bit already about the kind of emotive impacts, if you like, the fact that it's hit the NHS. And, you know, there's obviously political manoeuvres going on there as well, and we can see that there's various different issues in terms of who should have been patching or what should have been happening. But can you put it into a bit more context?
A bit more context in terms of?
Just in terms of how the NHS, you know, the fact that it's such a loved organisation.
Yeah. So here's a couple of things that I've learned just over the last couple of days. Mm-hmm. And that you should add. The NHS is a relatively unique type of organisation, being that it's a franchise operation with no direct mandate to patch machines or go to the latest level. So it's operating in a way very different than most businesses would operate. I think the reaction I just spent the morning with 15 CISOs. They were doing a panel. It was scheduled beforehand, but this was on everybody's mind. And almost all of them had some level of operational plan. When it comes through, what's the feed you look at? Where are you getting information? And they're trying everything they can over the weekend to kind of corral it, control it. Which systems am I exposed on and how do I patch it? I don't think the same process existed as effectively for something like the NHS. And there are probably dozens of other organizations that have the same level of exposure.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think that's actually part of the question we should be asking ourselves. I think we're really tuned to businesses protecting themselves from this level of a criminal capability. But as I saw this morning with the discussion with the CISOs, their lives were very much impacted because the NHS created such panic. And so everybody in their organization created a level of panic around it because it became very emotional. And so the question came down to, so who has responsibility for what would arguably be a weaker part of the infrastructure here? That probably is a political question, not necessarily simply a IT question or a CISO question, which I think raises the questions I think you guys are looking at, which is, you know, who should be responsible to fix? I think we can't forget, because I think there has been a little bit of the whose fault was this? And this was a criminal act. This was not a natural act. This was not somebody catching a disease. This was a criminal act, and the criminals are responsible for what they've done. Now, how do we protect elements of our infrastructure from this level of criminal act? That's on us to figure out as a society and through politics or legal means how we'd want to do that. We've taken measures to help the business community, to help consumers and everybody else say, look, ransomware is real, it's happening all the time, here's a way you can protect yourself. But I think what happened over the weekend raised the much broader question of, we as a society have to deal with this in a much more effective, responsive way.
I mean, it's a money or your life scenario, isn't it? And we've always had that.
It's not new.
Regardless of what the system might be.
Right.
But, you know, is it trickier because it's now that there are so many different IT systems that, you know, different organisations like the NHS use? I mean, we've also got the issue of legacy software as well. And in turn, they are being used for things like MRI scanners and, you know, like the really important kit that these hospitals need to keep moving. How do we mitigate against that?
We have to make a risk decision. And a lot of times those risk decisions have impact that can be beyond what we originally assumed. This is what the conversation was this morning with the CISOs. Somebody made a decision not to patch those machines, for whatever reason. Arguably, we have to dismiss the passion and the emotion from this. Some of these machines that got hit with the ransomware actually didn't have any data on them. They were not actually something that was, it just blocked you using an X-ray machine. But part of the reaction to it, a doctor saying, well, I can't move forward if this thing has been compromised, is something we got to work with education and process to determine how to react to these types of things so that we don't exaggerate necessarily the impact and can manage them more effectively.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to add to this conversation. You know, this wasn't an attack on the NHS, just to be clear. The NHS was one of, I think, what's the latest statistics on the sinkhole? What, 368,000 victims and infected computers?
Is it really
across
that
the
many now?
Yeah.
Well, that's to the sinkhole, right? So the likelihood is that it's more. There are some positive rays of light here. You know, the fact that last count, the criminals only had $72,000 in their Bitcoin wallets, so people aren't actually paying. So that's a positive thing as well. But, you know, I've heard people attack the NHS saying, well, you should have patched. But I can bet those people attacking and complaining probably have never done a day's work in IT in their lives, right? They stand to the side and start throwing mud. And, you know, we as an industry and a society, we're really quick to point the finger at, you know, whether it's the organization that had the exploits in the first place, whether it's the organizations that didn't have the patches in place. But it's not easy to patch. It's not easy to migrate from Windows XP. It's not, you know, it's not as simple as just going, well, I'm just going to install the updates. And in many cases, you're running legacy applications which have a reliance upon an operating system which is old. What are you going to do? Are you going to say, well, I know what we'll do. Because it's on Windows XP, we're just going to switch it off. I'm sorry, no one else is going to get any more, you know, MRI scans. I mean, the clinical decision has to kind of weigh first, I think, in these scenarios. So, you know, back to what Hatem said, it was a risk-based decision. So we just have to figure out ways that, we just have to figure out ways that we begin to reduce that risk, because this looks like an issue that we're going to be contending with in our future society.
Okay, and I mean, the other key thing on that as well is that it's not just XP, is it?
No.
It's various other Microsoft operating systems, and you know, there's also this battle right now between NHS Digital, which are kind of saying, you know, it's only 4.7% of XP machines running now in hospitals across the country. And then at the same time, you know, we've
We've also got other issues in terms of how IT managers are actually dealing with it on the shop floor, if you like.
But I mean, XP is still the world's third most common operating system.
Absolutely.
And I think the reason people point to XP as being the example is because it was end-of-life in 2014. So, of course, you know, we can talk about patching, but if you're running Windows XP, it's a moot point. I guess that's why Windows XP has probably been, I guess, the center of discussion. But look, I don't want to scare people listening to this, but the majority of our critical infrastructure, or a lot of our critical infrastructure, is based on Windows XP. I think it might have even been an Ars Technica article in which they said 95% of cache points run on Windows XP.
Yeah.
So the third most common operating system, and yet everybody's blaming the NHS. Mm. It doesn't really add up, right?
Well, so let's talk then about Microsoft's responsibility. Some people have said that Microsoft has a duty to continue supporting these systems no matter what, that it should never stop supporting them, especially when they're so integral to critical systems. Thoughts?
That's a good point. I understand why people say that. I do. But, you know, at some point, like as a technology firm, you know, at some point they have to make a decision and say, well, okay, it's time to move on. I mean, you know, what's going to happen in the future whereby, you know, one person's got a penny farthing and, you know, we've got to continue supporting penny farthings? Or, you know, at what point do you kind of say, well, actually, we can no longer support this? It can't continue forever.
Well, so, yeah, but hang on, but this penny farthing isn't a penny. It's not. I mean, it's an MRI scanner. It's a cash point.
Yeah, but this
doesn't Microsoft really need to continue supporting this when they're so critical?
I think we're in a little bit of a no man's land. So arguably, Microsoft could say we will perpetually support it, but they will charge people for that.
And I think they do to an extent.
To an extent, yeah. Yes. The alternative is they could shut the machines down. They could basically say, look, when XP is done, XP is done. You have to now go and upgrade and buy. That's a very expensive proposition for a lot of companies. When we talk about infrastructure all running on XP, it's not because it's bad. It's because it actually does the job it's supposed to do. And no one wants to spend 50% of their resources going back and updating machines just because time had passed and we no longer want to provide any type of update to it. So we have to kind of balance what a business would need to be able to do in order to support its customers. And at some level, I think, you know, you're asking a good question, is if this is a service offered to citizens, is it a corporation's responsibility or is it a government's responsibility to ensure the perpetual support for something?
So I think it's your fault, personally, right?
No, I think somehow I knew we were coming.
Yeah.
It's all coming back.
Is it all work in the news corrupt media?
Well, yeah, I think it's the media. No, sorry, that's somebody else. No, but think about this. You know, we as consumers, we as the customers of Microsoft, we're the ones that are turning around saying, well, you know what? I don't want just Snake on my phone. I want to be able to do my online banking. Well, I don't want just to be able to make telephone calls. I want to be able to unlock my car and track my children. And, you know, we as the market are pushing technology companies by telling them that we want more features, we want more technology, we want more, 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 more. And yet, when they give us these things, more, 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 they'll go, well, okay, look, at some point, you know, we don't have unlimited resources, so at some point, you're going to have to say, well, okay, these older systems that we have, these legacy systems that we have, we're going to have to focus our resources upon giving the market what they want. I mean, isn't that the fundamental requirement of a commercial company?
Well, so this raises the question of whether commercial companies are equipped to deal with this sort of thing. I have to say, I think that it's a bit rich in a way to blame consumers for wanting more. Microsoft has made billions and billions of dollars out of this. Don't they have a responsibility to carry on providing for their consumers, or should it be a government thing? I mean, is it possible to imagine a world in which systems like this were nationalized?
Oh. Yeah, okay, well,
you're forgetting one important aspect of the story, which is the government is actually partially responsible for what happened.
and we really want to move on to this. So yes, tell, so, and this is exactly.
I don't mean to take us off.
Just to be clear, Hatem said that, right?
But this is exactly what Microsoft said. They blamed the NSA.
I read that letter, and I thought it was really well positioned. It said, look, you have an obligation at some level if you're going to be creating tools like this and have exploits in the software to immediately notify the vendor so that they can protect people who are citizens. When you don't do that and this stuff gets released in the wild, this is part of the problem. Now, I think there is some attempt to address this, but this is part of the issue that needs to get worked through. That, you know, there are exposures in these softwares that will never go away because human beings are building these things. How they get exploited and how that falls into the hands of criminals, that's a government responsibility.
How simple a process is that, though, for the NSA or GCHQ? Because obviously they have their own reasons for keeping this private.
They do. And they've shown to be very effective at exploiting that privacy.
Yeah, because in a way, it's almost that the problem here, from a systems point of view, isn't that the NSA spies on people and finds exploits. It's that they allow those exploits to leak.
But it's unlikely to be a conscious decision. I don't think they said, well, oh great, we've got all of these tools, let's just give it to an organization that nobody really knows who they are and get them to publish it to the world. I think, again, we've come into this scenario which we're trying to find a scapegoat into trying to find, are we seriously going to sit here and go, oh, well, I'm really shocked that intelligence agencies have these types of tools and techniques? I mean, we're all grown up here. We know that these things probably happen. There was somebody that actually made that perfectly clear a couple of years back and is, now living somewhere in Eastern Europe. So why are we surprised about these things? I mean, quite frankly, what I think we should be focusing on really fundamentally is that there needs to be this recognition that cybercrime, ransomware, publications like yours shouldn't be on the left field. We shouldn't. It's mainstream stuff because look at the impact that it's had on people. Individuals weren't able to get patient care. I've got a very close family member in hospital right now, and his impact to him was he's not got access to the internet. And I know it sounds small, but it's his only link to the outside world, and he's been in there for 4 weeks. This is cyber or digital. It's not even about cyber. This is about crime. Mm. And the quicker people understand that, personal data that they give away for chocolate is not a good idea, or the fact that, toy companies like VTech end up breaching, children's data and then turn around and say, well, it's not our responsibility. These are the issues that I think we need to be discussing. And I think the quicker people stop watching crap like isn't Deal and No Deal is still a show? I don't even know if that's still on TV. But the sooner that we begin to kind of really discuss and raise these are the issues of the 21st century.
Okay, so Microsoft has called for a digital Geneva Convention. That's requiring governments to report vulnerabilities to the creators of the software instead of, as they like to call it, stockpiling or selling or exploiting them. So do you guys agree with this vision?
I'm pragmatic. And, we can sit here. I've heard discussions around internet or digital, or is it computer driving licenses? You remember that? Or my favorite one was the digital kite mark. Remember this one? These are good ambitions to aim for, but I think in the meantime, let's just get on and figure out a way that we can collaborate and work together. And I know I talk about no more ransom, but that's an example whereby we just kind of said, well, look, we realize that we haven't got a world police. We realize we don't have a digital Geneva Convention, I think it was. Let's just figure out a way that law enforcement, private industry can collaborate, work together, and do something for the public good. And, we've prevented over 10,000, or we've decrypted 10,000 infected computers since launch. And that's millions of dollars that haven't gone into the hands of criminals. So maybe that's a policy discussion. We can go around and have 101 meetings and discuss it. But from my perspective, and that is just, I think that is my perspective. I'm not speaking on behalf of the company here, but let's just figure out a way that we can actually make the world safer as quickly as we can, because I don't want this to occur again, but we know it will at some point.
Talking about the criminals, the perpetrators, who do you have any sense of who might have done this? Because there are a few theories out there. I'd really like to get your perspective on the possible identity, Raj.
So, absolutely. The question... And so, okay, so I'm going to sidestep this, unfortunately. I'd love to sit down and give you all of the gossip that I know, but...
No, I think that would be really great.
Yeah, I'm sure it will.
I don't think that you should hold back.
So one of the things that we do, and this is a corporate, I guess the way that we've approached attribution is we don't tend to do attribution through technical indicators alone. Now, I've seen that there have been a number of organizations and a lot of our partners have actually gone out and named the perpetrators behind this particular attack.
So to put a name on that, the group from North Korea, for example, which I think Kaspersky Labs has linked to the attack.
Yeah, and I've got great respect for the Kaspersky research team. They're phenomenal researchers. They're great people. But I personally wouldn't feel comfortable making any attribution claims solely upon technical indicators. I mean, and actually, what we do is we've got MOUs with a number of police agencies across the world. What we do is we do technical analysis and provide technical indicators that allow law enforcement, who I believe are the organizations that should be doing attribution, as well as identifying the source of attacks. And so I know it's probably like the lamest answer you've got, and I know it's not what you wanted, but that's probably all I can comment on that.
I mean, the problem is it's relatively early and it's very speculative, and it may make us feel better to feel like we can point to someone and say, well, that was the person who did it, and if we just grab that person, everything is fine. But the problem is everything is not fine. The problem is, as Raj pointed out very eloquently, this is an ongoing issue, and every individual has to think about how they're going to protect themselves and the obligations they have to their businesses, because this is not going to necessarily go away, even if the one attack we found the perpetrator for. I mean, it's delivered as a service now. You can go online and order ransomware as a service and pull whatever money you need from it. And that's not the only type of attack that people are dealing with. I think one of the people this morning, I think, highlighted, while this is good because it got people's attention around the importance of dealing with ransomware and cybercrime, it's bad because it's actually bringing us back about 10, 15 years in terms of the type of attack that has happened versus what's happening much more prevalently and much more dangerously, which the industry needs to spend its time focused on how to fix. So there's a little bit of a mismatch in terms of what we have to address going forward and what we've been dealing with over the last few days. That being said, I think it does come down to the individuals. I think we can all point at whose fault and where that fault comes from. But even just back to the question about the Digital Geneva Convention, I think it's a really good idea. But I think at the same time, I really want my intelligence services doing what they're doing, which is arguably protecting the citizens of the country from the bad guys. And sometimes they're going to need tools to be able to do that, and I don't necessarily want to inhibit them from having those tools. My privacy is very important to me. My personal information is very important to me, but so is my life. And so I don't want to necessarily dismiss and say, bad guys, good luck, because the NSA is now going to be hampered from being able to deal with it, or MI6 or anybody else who's in the intelligence community. Their job is to actually figure out how to protect the overall citizens of the country. So there's this whole balance thing that's going around between whose responsibility, from the NHS to Microsoft to the NSA back to the individual, that I think really forces us to ask ourselves, okay, so am I doing everything I'm supposed to be doing to protect myself? I lock the doors in my house, I have an alarm, I lock the windows. I need to act responsible for what I have. I'm wondering if we'd have the same conversation if somebody walked in with a gun and took a hospital hostage. Would we be asking them why didn't they have better patching or better security? No. We would be really upset at the person who took the hospital people hostage. I think we need to maintain that frame of reference. and not get overly passionate.
Is that the reality? Is that, you know, we cannot stop all of these attacks? It's just it's a way of life.
I think bad people exist, and we have a responsibility to put gates and locks and security and leverage No More Ransom and other sites like that to make sure that, you know, we're doing the diligence that we need.
No, but I don't think we can just wave our hands and go, well, that's our future. No, absolutely not. You know, we do, I always remember, I kind of use the analogy of Lord of the Rings. I think it shows that I'm in tech, right, by doing that. But if I remember rightly, you know, when Gandalf, I think it was maybe in the first or the second film, they'd just left the mines of Mordor, and they're being chased, and he kind of says, all right, you go ahead, Frodo, and he stands and he puts his staff down and he goes, you shall not pass. And that's kind of the moment that we have here. You know, this is your shunak. This is that moment in which we say, you shall not pass. If you want to have a future in which your car is held to ransom, which, by the way, you know, we did research and showed cars are vulnerable to ransom. We showed cars are vulnerable to other things, right? We want a scenario in which cardiac equipment has been identified as vulnerable, and potentially, you know, life-threatening cyber-related attacks are going to be part of our future. Then let's just continue as we are. But if you want a different future, if you want something different, then look. Am I allowed to swear on this? I'm probably not, right? Stop being such a moron, and let's actually have a grown-up discussion about what can be done to mitigate, reduce the likelihood of this ever occurring again.
So this comes back to politics to an extent, doesn't it, really? I mean, we've seen the Digital Economy Acts come in here in the UK, and there's a whole section in there about data sharing and this need to kind of open up government departments so that, you know, they can access medical records and things like that. And, you know, for good purposes, some might argue for bad purposes as well. But will that encourage the baddies to do more attacks like this?
Well, we went through this years back. If you remember the Connecting for Health and National Program for IT, because we're having digital systems, there is the possibility that those systems can be targeted and people from all over across the world can try and target those. But equally, it just creates a different type of risk. And I'll give you a great case in point. You know, if you're at a hospital, and I'm sure the last time you were there, but, you know, in the past you'd have records clerks, and they'd walk around with a trolley with all of these medical records like piled high, and then they'd nip off for a coffee and they'd all be sitting there as well. Well, that creates a risk, of course. The thing with digital systems is that you have an audit trail, you have the ability to be able to use authentication. So, okay, you reduce the likelihood of somebody being able to just pick up a record, put it under their coat and walk away, but likewise, there's equally the opportunity that other people can potentially target them. And so, again, you know, let's have a grown-up discussion and say, well, okay, you know, these are the risks. How can we actually reduce those risks to a level that we as a society are comfortable with? Because we're in the 21st, you know, like a great example, right? We're in the 21st century. And if your car, for example, has a problem, you get a warning light. If you're running low on fuel, you get a warning light. And you can proactively do things to manage that particular car. Well, what about your human body? When do you get to see a medical professional? You don't get a proactive warning, generally. It's kind of like, oh, you know, I can't get up in the morning, or I'm, you know, really unwell, or someone's vomiting. And so we've got to look at different ways to be able to harness technology for the betterment of us, each of us as a society. So let's not run away from technology and say, well, let's switch everything off, because I think that would be the worst decision. And let's figure out ways that we can use technology in a safe and secure fashion so it is better for us.
Final question before we have to go. Is this going to get worse before it gets better?
Yes. I think it's probably... We're learning a lot from this latest attack, but I think people are also recognizing that there's a lot left to be done. I like what Raj is saying in terms of we can't just accept this as the go-forward model. We have to recognize that we have to improve. We have an obligation to improve. If I get to use a science fiction analogy, even in Star Trek, as noble and wonderful as everybody was in the 23rd or 24th century, there were bad guys. And everybody had to kind of figure out, when it went from Klingons to Romulans to whoever, how do you protect yourself and how do you make sure that you have a responsibility to manage that? I think that back to the kind of the original piece, the politics piece of it, there are very weak parts of our infrastructure. And I do believe we have an obligation as a society to look to the politicians and to look to laws and other pieces to say, this is no longer acceptable that a hospital, for example, can be exposed in this way. Somebody told me an interesting analogy. I lived in Los Angeles for many years. In Los Angeles, which is susceptible to earthquakes, you can't build a hospital that doesn't withstand a 7.0 earthquake. You have to, by law, put whatever you can do to withstand that earthquake. Should we consider that something like a hospital or a utility or something else is by law going to be required to maintain some level, and we have to invest in it and make the money, when we can't just say it is. It's kind of got to be something we have to be prepared as a society to spend on, because that level of exposure is more than we're willing to bear.
When it comes to earthquakes, 7 is a lot. Where would this ransomware attack on a cybersecurity Richter scale?
In terms of impact?
Yeah.
If you ask a patient that was impacted...
But from your point of view,
a 10. I mean, you know, it's all... Yeah, I mean, it's all relative, right? It's all, everything is all contextual.
It is.
You know, if you ask somebody sitting on a beach in Australia, it's like, well, okay, you know, it's like a 3. But if you ask the person that's being directly impacted, it's pretty high. And so, from my perspective, I think it's relatively high. Only because for me, I always measure things like impact. And the impact that it had to society, to patients, to all of us in terms of the trust in the systems that we rely upon society was very high. So I think it was relatively high.
I actually think you have to take the context in it. A 7.0 in Los Angeles, a lot of people could actually survive that. A 4.5 or 5.0 in Cairo or Bangladesh, which is kind of what we feel like right now, can take a lot of damage and hit. And I think we've got to prepare ourselves to be able to withstand, because this ransomware attack, while it was ubiquitous and it took a lot of notice, wasn't that sophisticated, and really surprisingly impacted a lot of people in a very small way, right? $75,000 or $57,000 of ransomware. I mean, it's not like the guy took hundreds of millions of dollars, which could have happened. It was relatively easy to stop, possibly by mistake, possibly not. It had a much more panic-driven model than let me go get some money from people and figure it out. That could be right, that could be wrong. Or maybe they just figured over a period of time it would hit everything they need. And as somebody told me yesterday, a 13-year-old kid may be ecstatic that they've got $70,000. We don't know yet. But I think that on the Richter scale of impact, we are not able to withstand a lot of things, as what we saw over the weekend.
Well, just really quickly, so actually on that, they haven't moved the money. The money is still there.
Yeah.
And in fact, we haven't actually even heard of, and I don't know whether you've heard this, but there's not been any cases where people have said, I paid the ransom and I got my money back.
Mm-hmm. Or
my data back. So this is slightly different. I mean, like, it's not like, you know, normal ransomware. Mm-hmm. Give us the money and we'll give you a key and then you'll get your data back. Mm-hmm. This is slightly different. You know, it's they haven't given you your data back. They haven't moved the money. So we're kind of going, well...
Are they even after money? That's one question.
Or is it trying to make a point? I mean, that, again, these are the questions that I think we need to be asking, really.
Okay, and we will be asking them in the coming weeks and months, I'm sure. Raj Hatem, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Great discussion.
Thanks, Kelly, as always.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next week. Goodbye.